Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. This podcast features a session from the EDUCAUSE 2012 annual conference. The presentation is entitled Blueprint for Change in an Era of Rapid Reinvention. Our speakers include Christine Flanagan, Student Experience Lab Director for the Business Innovation Factory, and Elliot Mazey, CEO for the Mazey Center.
The discussion about innovation in education includes many stakeholders who care very deeply about the future of education. What's missing in this conversation is the voice that matters the most, the voice of the student. Since 2009, the Student Experience Lab has traveled the country logging hundreds of hours, listening, observing, and analyzing how students interact with America's educational system. We've explored the social, emotional, and environmental factors that both propel and hinder success. So what are some of the things we've learned? Many students are unprepared for the reality of the college experience.
This is a dream that my mother put in my head. She said, oh, just go to school. We'll work, you know. We'll support you. We'll supply everything you need. But that it wasn't the case. It was like a sort of like a joke, like a sad, like a bad, bad, really bad joke. And it wasn't like that. So I have to work and I have to go to school at the same time. And if that were the case, I mean, if I weren't to work and just go straight to school, then it would be much easier. But I just got to get stronger.
I found it very difficult to find out what I needed to get back into school. How I needed to go about that and what needed to be done. It was one person would say one thing and then I do that and then, you know, I missed this. I was actually delayed a semester because everything was, it wasn't falling in place and no one really knew what was going on to help me get back into school. And it was such a frustrating experience.
I was sort of drowning in bureaucracy. I couldn't begin to understand what the best decision was or how I should handle this. And as I've gone through and, you know, I finished at Valencia and then started applying to other universities, I've sort of acquired this knowledge as I've navigated the system, learning by experience. I definitely wish I would have had it ahead of time.
Pressures of life outside of education can be catalyzing for some and daunting for many others.
I don't want to get into that habit of always wanting things or having handouts. I want to be able to work for myself. I want to be able to get my own things because it's going to happen one day where they're gone and I'm going to have to work for myself. So now is the goodest time as any. I'm a junior in high school. I'm 16. I got a job. I mean, I got to go out and start working. It's got to happen. I can't put it off forever. No one can.
You know, I was working 12 to sometimes 15 hours a day and in various jobs. And was married, and I still wanted to get that degree. I heard others talk about the degrees. You know, whether it was going to help me at all, it was irrelevant at that point. It was just a matter of just getting it, just to say I have it.
The value of education, both financially and experientially, is forcing many students to question its purpose or feasibility.
Some of the things that you think are really important, such as grades, may not be as important as doing things outside of the class and actually getting involved in what you want to do.
Education is changing. The 21st century learner is unlike any student, any learner that has come before. They want more from their experience than just a piece of paper that says, I accomplished something that they are unable to articulate.
How might we reframe the higher education imperative? How might we help students to develop a coherent, goal-focused educational experience? What if we put students in the driver's seat to transform education? These are some of the answers we seek. Chris, thanks for joining us. That was really powerful. You do listen to students. So let me ask you, those were some current students, but maybe you could help us
think a little bit more about where our students are going to be a few years now, because if we're going to transform education, we want to be transforming it for the next set of students, not just the ones we have today.
And I think that students today are kind of in the middle. I think some of those students who we are talking about for the future are those students residing today. So I think that's an important distinction to make, that as much as we are trying to solve the problem for tomorrow's students, there's a lot we can do for today's students to set the stage. And I still think we don't know enough. We still need to know more. We're in the midst of a research project right now, and one of those young men actually made it into this particular video. And sometimes we scratch our heads saying, we're just scratching the surface on the student experience and what that means. But in terms of today's generation of students and then tomorrow's generation of students, I'd say a couple of things. First, I think we need to reframe our own mental model around what a student is. If we look at traditional higher education students, our mental model is one of I go to school and I get to fully immerse myself in the experience. Lock, stock, and barrel. This is my life. This is education, and this is what I'm going to dedicate myself to. And while there'll be extracurricular activities and some part-time work, no one from a traditional mindset would deny the fact that the bulk of that student's life is the educational journey. And that's totally different today. And what we're finding is that academics in higher education reflects just a sliver of their whole life, and until we design experiences that take into account that whole life, we're really not creating the right pathway opportunities to degree and successful outcome.
So what things get in the way for students since they can't just study full time? What kinds of things do we need to be worried about for them?
I think it's life worries, right? I mean, you're dealing with, some of this sounds a bit redundant, but based on things we've heard even during the last couple of days, choice and affordability is huge right now. We have students, it's very interesting, I couldn't have said this 4 years ago, but a recent study of work we've been doing with students where they are no longer making choices based on where I want to go or what might be the best fit. They are applying to those schools, but then when they get in and you look at the list and who I have in front of me and where I'm going to go, far too often students are taking plan B because they refuse to go into debt. That's a big problem.
That's a big problem that really changes their options. So one of the things that you do with students is look at new models. And I'm just curious if you can describe some of the new models for learning that you've got for students, and are there any of those that work really well for particular groups of students? Because not everybody's the same.
And that's the whole point, right? Yes. Not everyone's the same. And we're at a point where we can say that and embrace it, and it's a really good thing because we have the opportunity to scale what we know works.
What works?
Competency-based learning works. Competency-based learning works. So I've been thinking about this a lot. In the lab, we've been focused on competency-based learning for close to a year. We've been working with Southern New Hampshire University to prototype a new online student experience that's task-based and competency-based. That's not based on seat time. Students will perform a series of tasks. They will earn competencies and demonstrate their mastery of these competencies, and that will roll all up into an associate's degree program. That's wholly different than the traditional model. The thing that I would say, though, about even competency-based learning, while it sounds new, it's not new. Competency-based learning, and we learned this a long time. I've been reflecting lately on that meeting we went to a few weeks ago. Diane and I were at a meeting down in D.C. It was put on by the Department of Education. There were a bunch of heavy hitters in the room, from policymakers to foundations to higher education presidents, and no surprise, a big topic of conversation was competency-based learning and how we can bring that to scale. And there was a gentleman at my table, and he's listening and he's nodding, and he's getting all tense in his seat, right? And he's starting to huff and puff and roll his eyes, and I'm looking at him, and I'm like, what is the matter with you? And he looks at me, he's like, I've been having this conversation for 40 years. This has been around for 40 years. Why is this any different? And, it didn't really hit me until I came here here, and I went to your convention hall, and you know, you've got amazing and smart solution providers out there, and that's the difference to make models that have been around for a really long time, but we bring them to scale. So when you talk about efficiency and productivity and delivering on the student experience, we actually can do that today, and that's a heck of a lot different than back in the 1970s.
It is. So competency-based learning is one type of model. Any others?
Service-based learning. I mean, we've had so many students who are looking at we would classify as extracurricular. They're looking at it as meaningful learning opportunities to add to their portfolio or their resume. I think what's really interesting about, I have lists of things that students have done in different programs, and they're all, some of them very small, and you say that you want to scale that. I think that what we have to start looking at is, and I was going to mention this earlier, there's this sort of revolution afoot on the part of students. And not just the elite students, the Peter Thiel fellows of the world, but also the non-traditional student who's struggling to make it work for them. They have an opportunity to build a sort of a la carte academic journey, if you will. Right? And it's an a la carte journey from a variety of restaurants, and those restaurants are starting to deliver to you, right? So that's one way of looking at it, as opposed to this sort of prefix at one particular restaurant. And more students are looking at those opportunities and building that holistic framework for themselves. Now, some they're not getting credit for it, so the onus is on them to articulate the value of some of these projects that they're working on or programs that they're working on, but some are getting really, really good at it.
So say just a word about how you involve students in the R&D process.
I'd love including students in the R&D process. So I am a big fan of, needless to say, it's kind of obvious, I work for the Business Innovation Factory. So we've been focused a lot on business model innovation. So it's not just tweaks or incremental changes to an existing system. It's about how do we actually transform a business model. And that is at the top of the food chain, if you will, in terms of an innovation process. When you start to do that, you know, you can argue that we should have experimental platforms in this place where we can have a neutral environment where we test new models, but there's still always that pesky problem of fear and of change and behavior change when you're talking about new models. And even if you're able in a external environment to create the new model, how do you incorporate that back into the core, which is very, very protective? We do that with students. So what we believe is that students can and should play an active role in the design and innovation of education. They should have an active seat at the table. We give students design tools and innovation tools. We create students who are systems thinkers so that it's not students outside of education coming up with these new ideas, which quite often are not executable, honestly, but more they're valued members of the table. And what's interesting is when students are at the center, the silos start to break down between departments, and because that's critical, right? I mean, you can't get people working together and everybody on the bus, because for business model innovation, you do need everybody on the bus. And students have a great knack for building culture that is willing to experiment more.
Excellent. Chris, thank you very much.
That's it? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Zach. Now, I'd like to introduce our next guest, and that's Elliot Mazie. And Elliot Mazie knows learning. He knows it in many different ways. He's acknowledged, actually, as the first analyst who coined the term e-learning. He knows about learning in Bank of America, in Walmart, Special Operations Forces, McDonald's, Boeing, Starbucks, corporations all over the world. He's the head of the Mazie Center, which is a think tank that is focused on how organizations can support learning in the workplace. He's a futurist. He's an analyst. He's a researcher in corporate learning, organizational development, and in emerging technology. Now, I also have to tell you that Elliot is a trustee. He's a trustee at Skidmore College. So just a reminder of another way that corporate partners are involved with higher education. Elliot? Thank you.
Thank you. Diana and I have become colleagues over the last couple of years because in many ways we work in parallel universes. You work in the higher ed space. I spend my time with the folks who take your graduates or even some of your current students and either help them guarantee that they are ready and perform in the workplace. So my world is what happens when people go to work and have to continue to learn. Now, as you said, I was somewhat involved. I either get blame or credit for the phrase e-learning in the corporate world. But I want to start with sort of a quiz. Do me a favor. Just turn to your neighbor for a second. What do you think the E in e-learning stands for? Just to your neighbor for a second. What does the E in e-learning stand for? Da-do-da-do-da-do-da. Okay, how many of you said electronic? How many of you said expensive? Okay, well, it was interesting because back when we started to use it, it was electronic. But what's interesting in the corporate world, that's irrelevant right now. The E actually, and sort of from the beginning, meant everywhere, everyone, effective, engagement. And in fact, in our world, we're not using the word e-learning anymore, the word e-learning. We're talking a lot about the connected learner. How do you take the learner and connect them? And I will tell you as a trustee, and we actually have your new board member, Justin, here. Justin used to work at Skidmore, now is going to a great other university. But we recently started to say, well, should the board take a position on e-learning? And I put my hand up and said, stop. We don't want to talk about e-learning. We want to talk about connected learning. How do we connect that learner? How does that learner get connected to other learners, to their faculty member, to expertise, to the workplace, to alums, all the way back to their high school teacher to blame them on, you know, the non-prep they might have had for a course there. But as we think about that, there also are a number of fundamental changes that are happening here. So once again, just to move to your neighbor for a second, how many of you are old enough to remember TV with antenna ears coming out the top? Okay, now just turn to your neighbor. How is TV different today than it was when you watched the Ed Sullivan Show at 8:30 at night on a Sunday? So just for 15 seconds, how is it different today? Okay. Well, it's kind of different. I remember 8:30 was a ritual. We were all there. Now, when you watch TV, how many of you are watching it on demand? Okay. How many of you are watching it with a tablet in your lap? Okay. How many of you are watching it with a tablet in your lap and another phone on the side over here? Okay. How many of you are watching it in the bathroom? Okay? It's very embarrassing to go to a public bathroom and hear broadcasts coming from the other booth. It's a really interesting issue there. But the reality is that what's happened to TV is happening to your world and my world. Because what the learner wants, and the phrase I want to use, Richard Collada is one of your speakers here, wonderful friend, a senior person working for Secretary Arnold Duncan, saying something very simple. We are in the age of personalization. Now, don't get all hoity-toity on me, okay? Because personalization becomes real when you think about it for yourself. How do you want to learn? Let's assume nobody else was watching. How do you want to learn? Here's how you want to learn. I want to learn the stuff I really need to know, that I don't know already, that I can't look up online. I want to learn it in a time frame that's convenient for me, for a duration that's appropriate, in a style that matches to my need, with a level of collaboration that's appropriate, with a type of assessment that I can take, with a credential or badge at the end that works. And the reality is it's different for Justin than it is for me. It's different for Sarah than it is for Vicky. And the reality is that we collectively in the education world are making the shift. Think about record companies when they heard about downloadable tunes. It wasn't an exciting day in the room for the people who are in the business of selling albums or CDs. Because suddenly when music personalization hit, stuff started to change. Now, our challenge, and I think what's really interesting, is how do we use evidence-based approaches to think about what institutions do? Now, just to sum up here, and then you can chat with me, Diana, about this, is organizations, for instance, let's take Walmart, okay? Walmart is looking at how does that employee, once they're hired, continue to learn. And they've got some incredible programs right now. By the way, how much do you think a manager of a Walmart earns? Okay, how many did you say? 50,000, 60,000. Okay, significantly higher. That person managing a Walmart needs an incredible set of competencies and the like. And they believe it won't happen just by the time they graduate school. They're going to have to make coming to work also coming to learn. So finally, it's that concept of a learner having authority. How do we get to the position where we mix what good pedagogy is, what good learning systems are, what evidence-based research, including looking at learning analytics and data to say, how does that learner succeed? What I'm excited about is your world and my world is separated only by that we use different jargon. We actually are in that same world of learning. So let's take a look at what's changing here.
Well, and what I'd like to do is, you mentioned Walmart. Tell us how much they really do make.
A manager there could make about $200,000 or so. What are they doing? They're managing a 24/7 operation, a couple hundred employees doing a whole slew of logistics and the like. Or another one, for instance, is I'm involved with Starbucks now in China.
Yes.
They're opening a new Starbucks every day in China for the next 2 years. Every day. They've got to train 130 people to literally take their order in Mandarin, talk to each other in English, and sell, most of whom have never had coffee before they started to work at Starbucks. And that's not an e-learning program. That's a drinking program in that process. So
Elliot, one of the things that I think we forget, those of us on the higher education side, is that higher education is really only, a third of post-secondary education, that the majority of it is on the corporate side. And we've got student workers and worker students.
Right.
And a lot of these non-traditional or post-traditional students that we talked about earlier that Chris highlighted are in the workplace. What are some of the best practices that corporations are using to keep those people learning?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. One of the things that we're saying is let's eliminate the barriers. Let's create an environment when you come to work, you come to work to learn. And that's learning, and that's a connected sense from each other, from institutions of higher education. So Walmart and Starbucks and other major corporations are having robust relationships with institutions of higher education so students can continue to learn. And by the way, we thought they all wanted credit and graduation, and some do, but most want the self-concept and the badge that they are in a learning process. They may not want the credential, but they want to be in that process. The other part is flipping it around. How do we make sure that the workplace is reflected in the conversations in higher ed, and that higher ed has a presence in the workplace? Now, I think connection, I think video is incredible. Why aren't we in our student classrooms regularly going out to workplaces around the world and using expertise as part of our learning process there?
It's a good question, and maybe that's one of the challenges that we are going to face in the future is how do you engage students better by having them brought into that. But one of the other things that you've talked about before that I think is very interesting and plays into what we want to do with education is what do people really need to know? In the corporate world, education is pretty purposeful, and you also look at what higher education produces, but what are they really trying to get across?
Well, let me give you an interesting example. There's a great TED Talk done by Betsy Sparrow, a professor from Columbia University. How many of you use a partner, spouse, or friend as an extender of your memory? Okay. So Betsy would say that she can't have a conversation about sports when her husband isn't there, but she uses him as an on-demand reference for a sports conversation.
What's interesting in the corporate world of learning, what we're finding is a smaller percentage of what they need to learn, they need to know at the deep memory level. Mm-hmm. But what they need to be able to do is have transactive memory. Know, for instance, where to find it, who to find it from. One of the reasons why we're real interested in social and collaborative learning is the assumption may not be that everybody on the team needs to know it.
Right.
Everyone on the team needs to know who knows it and how do they continue that process. We also think what we have to do is build an agility for the learner to accept that what they are about to learn has a relatively short half-life. I've had the honor of being on a board with Secretary Riley. And as Secretary of Education, Riley said something very directly. The half-life of most of what we teach at institutions is less than 4 years. When they go to the workplace, they better be refreshing that half-life, or they might be refreshed along the way. So how do we create the environment that you come to work every day to learn, you come to teach, and there are vibrant connections? I will tell you as a trustee, what annoys me the most, even about Skidmore, is when they... as they walk across the stage, and by the way, you're the only institution in the world that spends a lot of money to recruit customers and then fires them with music and costumes 4 years later. And then you give them a card to become a donor, and none of them will for 20 years. You know, why don't, as they walk off the stage, we hand them the online learning process to continue their fifth year afterwards, and then 10 years later get them involved as mentors and the like. So how do we hyper connect our students?
Right. So when you did your opening remarks, you mentioned learner authority.
Yeah.
And you didn't have a chance to say a lot about that, but I'd like you to talk about what that learner authority means to higher education.
I'm not talking about a kumbaya model of learning. Okay. I'm not saying let each person learn physics the way they want to learn it. Okay. In reality, I'm talking about more specific competencies, mm-hmm. more specific assessment. I'd rather have fewer people pass their courses the first time. I actually flunked statistics in college because I had a professor who says the most dangerous person is a person with a B in statistics. Okay.
That was great motivation.
And then I took it again, and I chose him to take it with, okay? But what we really want is we want to not see their transcript. We want to see their competency map when they get done. And what a learner authority gets at is each learner brings a different set of content, mm-hmm. has a different cognitive processing map. You may be an extrovert. We know that 25% of your students are introverts, and we walk around saying they know how to be social. They don't want to be social, per se. We've got to figure out how do we create that personalization, and how do we then use research to indicate what works,
yes.
what doesn't work, and you don't learn most things in one pass. My biggest problem with learning is we assume it's a sheep dip. You know, we dip them and they get it. In fact, a lot of things take incubation, reflection, refraction, and more time to hit in that sense.
So one other question for you. What do corporations think about how higher education is doing?
Well, corporations are enormously both grateful, and they're grateful with donations and the like. They're amazingly dependent. What they don't get is that in many ways the speed of change that you have may not be the speed of change of what they need. So right near Saratoga, we're putting in the largest nanotech factory in the world. Okay. Now, one community college there got it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
They built a
benefit.
Facility right next to them. But I will tell you, in most situations, the agility time of institutions for higher education is measured in decades, not months, in that process. We believe that by having a more fertile relationship, we can be teaching the way we need. And by the way, if you don't have the faculty, if a student wants to learn Arabic, let him take it from somebody at another institution, online, or from a great professor in Egypt in that situation. And then let the institution, and as a trustee of a liberal arts college, I don't believe liberal arts colleges are going away.
No.
I just believe we're no longer going to be nun and priest-based sanctuaries in that sense. I actually think that our institutions are going to be great places of incubation, hyper-connected externally, and then be able to use the institution, as you said, in a blended level. And we believe ultimately that learners and their parents are going to become very a la carte. They're going to maybe say, I want to go to that institution, but they may spend 4 or 5 semesters other places getting the unique helicopter parent subsidized experience that their kid wants. And net net, you better be an enabler. You better keep very high standards, because when you give me somebody with a degree in business, I want him to be able at least to negotiate a contract, not just to have a nice conversation with other business students.
So, Elliot, I'm going to ask Chris to come out.
Great.
Because you just got into new models, and I think the two of you maybe ought to have this conversation together. Chris, thanks for coming back.
I think we should start the a la carte university.
I think so.
Who's going to start curator?
Somebody asked why I was wearing these very bright sneakers. I'm from New York. Is anyone else here from the New York area? We lost power. These would go on if we lose power here. They actually go. So it's a tribute to my New York friends right now. So.
You just need the foot warmers because they have no heat.
And how do you know I don't have
that? So now I'm going to ask you to talk about technology a little bit, because Chris, you mentioned technology earlier being one of the ways that we scale things. Elliot, you look at emerging technologies, and the one that of course we have to ask is required is MOOCs.
Okay.
What do you think about MOOCs?
Well, I love what a MOOC is, but a MOOC is a data point in a larger shift. Net-net, I took an 86,000 person MOOC. I recently was a faculty member. But I'm less interested in the massive course part. I'm interested in the O. I'm interested in the open part of that. So how do we now convert things? I'm imagining the MOOC will evolve into multiple models, including, by the way, to me, the replacement for the textbook is an e-book that has a MOOC-like quality to it and can be used in a variety of ways. Let's not make the mistake, though. Very often inventions hyper mimic what we left. So TV mimic radio, webinars mimic PowerPoints, and MOOCs are trying to mimic classroom courses. I'm interested in what the next level, and I know that's the world that you're operating in with this concept of experimentation.
Experimenting and openness. We talked about this a little bit yesterday. MOOCs, for the way I view it, is they're still conceptual. But they're ripe for, it's a true open experimental platform where groups and groups of people are contributing. So when you think about rapid prototyping, that's the ultimate environment for it, because you are learning on the go, on the fly, persistently. So while we no longer have to wait for the decade to get it right, we'll be getting it right and we'll be iterating upon it year after year after year.
And Diana, one of the things I also worry about is, by the way, in our world, most e-learning is way too easy. I love failure.
Yes.
Okay, I'm a big believer you fail your way to success. Most MOOCs, everybody passes. Most students do not want to be in a video game in which everyone passes. Okay, so we've got to think about how do we increase the competency levels, the risk level, and even the failure levels. So it may be it takes 11 years to complete that MOOC, but who cares? Let's get them to a point of real competency.
So let's talk about another issue that MOOCs raises, which is the credentialing part. So you can take the MOOC, but you don't necessarily get more than a piece of paper. What's going to happen with credentialing? Badging is big, and it's come from the corporate side, but it's not only there. And, Chris, maybe the students want that.
Students definitely want it. Students see value in it, but they're seeing value in it right now for themselves because it's very purpose-driven, and they're deriving immediate value and relevance from it. However, until employers start accepting those new forms of credentials in the same fashion they would, say, with a degree, we're going to hit some roadblocks. And that could also, again, come from, I spoke about this earlier, the student revolution. I mean, if I can't afford higher ed, and I may actually demonstrate better competency through a credentialing program where I get a badge as opposed to a degree, employers will begin to start to value that process.
And in our world, those badges have to be very, very specific and tough. I serve on the Board of Visitors for the Central Intelligence Agency University. We redid training of new spies and of new folks there. We made it almost more badge-oriented, meaning here's what you need to know, here's how you can test out, and we are a little bit open about how you get there, But you get it. Now I want to go to the next step. Your badge doesn't last long.
That's right.
Because your badge needs to be recertified based on experience or the like.
So do you foresee a day when higher education and corporations work closely on this trade-off? I can take some of my course here. I can credential that. I can sweep it all together into something that's bigger.
I think you'll see three phenomena. One, we will start to hire people in their sophomore year, but they'll continue to be your students for 2 years. We'll have interns with them. We want to help structure some of their course experiences. The second element is to really make sure that they get street-level certifiable badges on the way out. People will shoot me, but liberal arts students have a great background, but I really want them to also have project management skills. I want them to have something that helps them get hired in any number of liberal arts stimulated fields the next day. And lastly, we need to get our faculty to spend time in the workplace. Because our faculty, who are first-level coaches, are often radically removed from the reality of what our students will hit when they come in.
So, Chris, would your students like to get hired in their sophomore year?
Absolutely. Well, they are being hired in their sophomore year, and they're making $10 an hour flipping burgers. The idea of being able to be hired, and I'm learning and I'm acquiring skills and competencies, and I'm getting paid for it, because, I mean, that is the future. Right. That's the future.
And so how do we know? The quality, and how do you personalize this? I'm actually, if I go to a technical question, what do you think about analytics?
Well, I think analytics are incredibly important because we have a lot of black box mythology in that area. You know, we can even just say, look, somebody graduates with an undergraduate degree in business, but what are they capable of doing? I mentioned earlier, can they negotiate a contract? They know how to interview somebody or any number element. But what we need to also do is to get to small, medium, and big data, which means let's look across 1,000 people teaching that and decide, for instance, sequence needs to change. We need to start with experience and end up in theory. And by the way, if we don't do it, our learners will. And our learners will, I believe, start to choose institutions based on the pedagogical choices they can make within those institutions.
Yeah. Let me just throw out, I'll be slightly contrarian here, I think we're all a little punch drunk on analytics, and I think that the problem is we aren't trained to adequately assess the data streams. Right. There's so many being thrown that you have people are just tuning out. You do not know how to assess multiple data streams. So then you go back to your lowest common denominator, which is my own personal experience. Mm-hmm. So in as much as data can be incredibly valuable, we have to take a lot of time to actually train people to understand the data streams and how to assess it and how what the implications that is either for the employee or the student.
Yeah.
Well, and we don't exchange data, do we?
We don't exchange data once again. We give somebody a transcript, not a competency map as they leave it, including the realities when they finish whatever institution, they're not done. They did pretty well. Most professors aren't like mine. They will let you get a B in statistics. Now how do we get to that delta gap once we hire that person?
Yeah. What kind of risk is there with, Chris, you said you don't sort of buy all the analytics stuff. Is there sort of a technology bubble thing that we're at risk of thinking it's all too cool? And I say that from a technology organization standpoint, too.
Well, how many of you are geeks on some level? Okay, so I'm in a room that gets it. Now, here's the problem. You know, I've got my iPad mini out there, and I've got my Microsoft tablet and the like. But our problem is we fall in love with the technology rather than the educational affordances that it creates. Okay, I had an argument with somebody on the trade show floor yesterday about why they had an app versus HTML5. I won't mention who they are, but you know, but I argued that they better figure out a way that students can modify their app because that's what's coming in that sense. But if you fall in love with the technology, you don't get to the next step, which is the experimentation, including when do we turn it all off? Right. When do we create disconnected environments? When do we create situations in which technology isn't the medium, but it's actually something we're removing people for a period of time?
You know, I wrote, this is interesting, 10 years ago I was in the corporate side and I wrote a paper about we need to bridge the IT marketing divide. Back then it was, that was the divide, and marketers could not speak about IT, and IT thought marketers, you people have no clue and we can't execute any of this. We're kind of in the same situation now with higher ed, that there is a communications divide between IT and higher ed, but there's also, that's a divide that has to be closed, because at the end of the day, students understand technology, and they're going to look at that and say, you've got to be kidding me, why isn't this working?
Yeah. So, Elliot, you're a trustee. What's the appropriate role of trustees, in your opinion, for getting involved with technology or telling institutions where to go next with learning? And Chris, I want you to comment on that.
It's a changing and even dangerous role. There was one institution which trustees got very opinionated. Oops, there went the president in the process. Oops, they're back, you know. But I think it's really important that trustees do two things. First of all, we find that now many of the trustees are ahead of the administration, even ahead of the faculty in this, because they're out there experiencing themselves. Their kids are in programs. They're, you know, they lost 20 pounds online with Weight Watchers and now think, why can't we do that in other elements? What I think the role of trustees is what it always is. I think our goal is the strategic plan. I think institutions need some really fresh strategic plans around the connected learner. And I think it's around fundraising. I think to get the kind of, you know, we spend so much on buildings, so much on grounds, but to really have the kind of connected environment where we can is going to require trustees thinking about what's going to be our ongoing IT, our ongoing connected environment. And then I think it is to allow the university to take risks and fail. I want to create labs so you can try something, call it a lab, and let it fail along the way, including getting some of your students as garage-based venturists to build. You know, you may or may not go to a high, big consulting corporation. Mm-hmm. See if you can find 10 students who can build an applet or an app or something. But we need to create an environment of experimentation.
Chris?
Completely agree with that.
That's kind of your story, isn't it?
That's my story, yes. Experimentation. And this having the opportunity to have a risk-free environment, when you get to the business model level, you will fail, and you will fail repeatedly. And as long as you're rapidly learning from that, you will eventually come to a point where there's a viable business model there. But you've got to create that environment for it. And right now, higher ed, I mean, that's a really tricky space. Even some of the universities that we work with, there's a bit of deceptive innovation going on where we can't really even say we're about business model innovation because too many people would be fearful. So, you know, this is an experiment that we're running, and we bring in people who may or may not be, who may be interested and are interested, and then you slowly bring it back. So we don't have a lot of time to do it, but build in enough time so that you can get the capital rolling inside to say, okay, let's try this. But you will fail. And if you're not failing, and I had a gem from IBM say, if you're not failing, you're doing something wrong, baby. Yeah.
Well, and one of the things you mentioned yesterday is just how rapidly the models are changing. We've talked more about learning models, technology. Say a bit about business models per se, because those are changing pretty fast, but
Business models. So let's talk about business models, and I'll talk about outside of higher ed. The shelf life of the average business model is shrinking. I mean, the data supports that story. So a CEO who may be able to iterate on one business model during the course of his or her career now may have 10, 12, 15 years to do it. So where's the lab? Where's the understanding? Where's the knowledge on the part of the CEO to say, I need to rapidly prototype new business models? That doesn't exist right now. And although it hasn't quite touched higher ed the way it has the corporate world, it's coming. I mean, that train has left the station. The current business models within higher ed, you could argue, are just not sustainable. So unless we start experimenting.
I also believe we're going to get some very new players in the field. And by the way, some of them are going to fail, some are going to succeed. Yep. Every major newspaper, every major publisher is going to be in this space. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to see corporations, for instance, offer paid internships at $25,000 a semester to really have a unique business, science, nature, or other experience. And I also think we're going to get personalization on duration. I think there are a lot of kids who cannot afford to spend 4 years to get a BA, and there are a lot of folks who would like to spend 8 years to do that. So our need, and it's hard if you're selling a dorm-based experience to do that.
It's unaffordable.
But that innovation will occur, and the marketplace will support it.
So let me ask each of you if you've got a challenge that you would leave our EDUCAUSE members with for what we need to do to make education better.
I have two. I have one, which we're going to be, I don't want to repeat ourselves, is around this idea of experimentation and building a safe platform environment where you have the permission to try new things. And then the other one is around bringing students into the design process. I have seen firsthand the value of looking at students as equal stakeholders as opposed to a group of people we are designing for. It is an act of co-creation that we do with and not for. And the more that you can do it, that behavior and cultural change that is so required for business model innovation will begin to occur.
And to cheat, I'll have two, too. One is visualization. I think that our students want visualization. They want to understand what they're learning, what they've learned. They want to leave, whether it's on the cloud or on a USB port, a lot more than what you call an e-portfolio, but something I can plug in my first day at work. The second element is I'm a boomer. I'm 62, and I'm in the middle of my career. Okay? We're not leaving. We're not leaving. And our campuses better be darn ready for us, because I know a lot of people who at age 62 are going to now take their next credential, their next element. And how do we get, and we've never done this, true multi-generation campuses? Because we right now are single-generation dorm-based environments. We're going to become significantly more diverse and be ready for the boomers, which means no more 8-point type in purple, okay? You know, font change time.
Absolutely true.
And check some of the MOOCs, though. If you look at the community right now in some of these online environments, you are seeing multi-generational. You don't see it on campus, but you're seeing it online, and the tremendous value from that those cross-generational approaches in thinking and learning and doing, it's crazy and valuable.
And just to cheat, Diane, I know we're short on time, but I also want to encourage you to talk about this field. Go to an MBA program and talk about the excitement of doing what you do. Find somebody who's in their 20s and support them coming to this conference next year. Because really at the end of the day, and my other trustees will yell at me, the campus of the future will not be known by the pretty buildings that it builds. It will be known by how connected they are, the level of experiment they have, the E becoming experience, not electronic, and how well that's woven together in a research-based, experimental, changing business model.
Yep. So I'm going to give each of you one final statement to leave our audience with. What final word would you give them?
Collaboration. I'm going to leave you with collaboration. We're not going to be able to get there in isolation. It's going to be grossly uncomfortable. Working with people not only outside of your current business unit or department, but actually looking outside of your industry, there is a lot of value in adjacent markets. So we kind of have to get out of our way and admit there's a lot we don't know. We all have a point of view worth sharing, but we're all missing a ton. And I think in the spirit of that, we'll generate the collaborative opportunities that will enable what we've just been talking about.
Mine would be global. You better prepare your universities, your students, for operating in a global society. I travel around the world each year, and you are increasingly going to compete with students of equal or better ability who are now connected, but they have one advantage over your students. They're hungry. And competing against somebody who's an equal and who's hungry is a disruptive phenomenon. So you've got to figure out how do your experiences, even if they're on beautiful, isolated campuses, every month, every week, maybe every day, are connected globally. Students graduating with two languages, not just basically English in that process. And to really understand what globalization will mean for changing work. Increasingly, they're going to be working in a distributed fashion, across borders, in multiple languages, and they're going to need to learn how to operate and how to learn and teach on a global basis. And we've got to get our faculty ready for that, because I fear that that's not primetime TV for them.
Would you join me in thanking Elliot and Chris?
It was a pleasure.